Come on, son.
Yeah.
It's the Come On, Son podcast, and my name is Ed Lover, and welcome to the podcast, and it's been a long time coming. Before we start this podcast, I'd like to introduce to y'all the man who made Come On, Son possible. if it wasn't for this guy, there would have never have ever been a Come On, Son. Welcome to the podcast, my man whose studio he so eloquently and lovely and beautifully allowed me to record this podcast out of. My man DJ Drama's in the building. We are in Mean Street Studios up? In Atlanta, Georgia. What's up, my brother?
Thank you, man. It's an honor to have you in the building doing your podcast.
Well, here. Thank you, man, because if it wasn't for you, there would have been no podcast in the first place and no Come On, Son.
I know. I'm honored. You know, at the time I was a little aggy, but when it first happened, but you know, looking back on it, you know, I'm glad I could have helped be part of something legendary.
Yeah, let me give you the backstory on Come On, Son. At a time, I think it was a Jeezy party for his company, wasn't it?
It was it wasn't a birthday party.
It was a release party.
Was it? Nah, because it was way after the mixtape. It was like 07. It was 07. So I don't know if it was a release, but it was a Jeezy party at 112.
Right.
And but it wasn't the party. Come on, Son happened because me and Jeezy were having issues.
That's right.
We were having problems. And then, you know, he was speaking publicly about, you know, our issues. Everybody kind of knew we were having tension and everything. And then when it was my turn or when they came asking me, you know, where some of our issues came from, I had mentioned that, you know, I had played a Gucci Mane song at the Jeezy party.
Right.
And then, you know, and that was just part of how I was explaining my story. Mm-hmm. And then, you know.
And that was the catalyst for me to do a Come On, Son, because I really wanted to speak on that and a lot of other things that were going on. So I had a little MacBook, and I opened it up, and I started recording myself just doing various stuff. And I got to that story. And I was like, come on, Son Drama. You know this man got beef with Gucci Mane. You don't play no Gucci Mane shit at this man's party when this man is paying you. So that was the first I ever done. Now, if it had been for the fact, if I had known how to Chiron, I come from an MTV background.
Right.
Where everything that I used to do or whatever I used to say, whenever I used to do the Ed Lover dance, they would Chiron it and put it on the screen.
Uh-huh.
And it would flash Ed Lover dance. Uh-huh. And I wanted to do that, but I didn't have the means or the knowledge on how to do it.
Yeah, right.
So what I did was got a piece of cardboard. I had just moved into my house, and I got a piece of cardboard off a box that I was unpacking. It took a Sharpie, and I wrote Come On, Son on it, and I flashed it up to the camera, and I just kept doing it, and then I didn't know what to do with the video, so I gave it to my man Money Nels, who was working at
shout out to my man Nelson.
Yeah, shout out to Nelson. He was working for ThisIs50.com
right.
at the time, yep. And I gave
Which
it to Nels.
Blog
it
out.
Was crazy.
Yeah.
I gave it to Nels, and he didn't tell me what he was going to do with it, but he just posted the shit.
Yeah,
and he posted it, and the shit got like 100,000 hits in like 2 days.
Nah, the shit went crazy.
Yeah, it went bananas.
I was a little tight, I'm not gonna lie. I was definitely a little tight. I mean, you know, you definitely made a good point when you said it, but I remember feeling, you know, that was in the midst of, you know, shout out to my nigga Jeezy too, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And, you know, we were in the midst of it, and I just, you know, I didn't want to take any blame for anything. You know what I'm saying?
And so. that was it, man. From there on, people, you know, Nels was like, you know, I remember reading it the first time, and I would read the comments.
Right.
And that's the worst thing you can do when you post something is read the comments. And it was a lot of shut the fuck up, Ed Lover.
Yeah.
You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yeah. Fuck you, old niggas. Mm-hmm. Stay out of young niggas' business. It was a lot of shit like that. And I remember Nell saying to me, my dude, they watch the shit.
Absolutely.
And that's all that matters. Absolutely. Is that they watch it. You got to do another one. 100%. And that's how Come On, Son started. Thanks to this man, DJ Drama, right here.
Shout out to my man, Trendsetter Sense, too. You know?
Yeah, Sense in the building.
Because, you know, I remember being a little intoxicated at that party.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and my Guwap was hot at the time, you know, and I asked Sense, like, yo, should I play this record? And he was like, yeah, play it. And then, I mean, it's not his fault. You know,
right.
I made my decision on my own.
Clarify this, though.
Yeah, of course.
Clarify.
Yeah, please clarify it. All right,
look.
Yeah.
Now,
I don't think his mic is on. Hold on. Let's get that.
Okay, check.
It's not on.
Nah, that mic's not hot.
What number is it?
Probably four. Yeah. Four. Just turn them up. Yeah.
Yo.
There you go. All right. Since tell the story, bro. All right.
So hold up. It's a little more detailed than that because at the time, I don't think we knew that the beef was that serious. I think we was just partying. That beef between us and Jeezy at the time, that happened 2 years after
absolutely.
The party.
Okay.
So the part, that was just, that. But Jeezy did get pissed off, though.
No, yeah,
I do remember
mad.
That.
Yeah, no.
But the beef wasn't, like, that serious at the time. Or we didn't know nothing that seriously
we
about
shouldn't
it.
Have played the record.
We shouldn't have played the record.
But you know what I mean? On some real shit, like.
That's hindsight. In hindsight, you know it now.
And it's tough. You know what I'm saying? I mean, coming from a media standpoint and how hip-hop works and, you know, us being DJs and not to. Looking back on it, clearly I would have done things differently. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? But, you know, sometimes when you, as a DJ, when you're in a zone or you're in a party, you know, and it's music out and, you know, some who's in the building and what have you, you know, you can get caught up. I mean, people have issues, mm-hmm. you know, and our job is to, you know, entertain the crowd. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's a fine line.
Right.
But granted, it was a Jeezy party. Therefore,
okay.
You know,
right.
Mistake made.
All right, and mistake corrected. So you guys have been good ever since.
Absolutely.
Is that
great.
The only, I think, is that, from my knowledge, that's the only real out there beef you've ever had besides with the fucking Federal Bureau of Investigation. But is that your only beef ever?
I've had a couple issues.
Really?
Yeah. I've had
other DJs?
The name drama is, you know, has been the gift and the curse.
Okay.
For sure.
Really?
Yeah.
With like who? With other DJs? Like,
have I have any issues? Well, you know, there was, me and Envy kind of, there was a Breakfast Club interview we did, and it got a lot of hits because, you know, he had an issue with me at the time. And
okay.
You know, it got clarified on air, but. Yeah, that was one. Me and Slay went through a little moment.
Okay.
You know.
Well, who didn't Slay go through a moment with?
Right. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of all, you know, looking back on it, I felt like, I remember going to the Hip Hop Awards, rest in peace to Justo,
uh-huh.
When I first got nominated. This was like, you know, early on when people started recognizing me for my mixtapes. And I was like, you know, Slay was the drama king at the time. You know
right.
what I mean? And I felt like he was gonna have an issue with me because of that, you know. So as my popularity started to increase, and
right.
Sometime after that, I think he made a comment like, you know, I got my name from him, or you know, something to that effect, and whatnot, and you know, which was totally false. Like, I've had that name for years, you know, before I had ever heard of K-Slay outside of Star Wars, you know. But
mm-hmm.
But you know, it wasn't nothing like. Any issues I've probably had, you know, have kind of been handled.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Where did the name drama come from?
You know, the name drama came from, I had two friends who were older than me. One was my man named Hakeem and my other man named Bakari. Bakari was from Senegal. His name was Bakari Drame.
Okay.
And my man Hakeem used to always just call him Drama. And Bakari used to sell mixtapes on Broad and Gerard in Philly. And he was also like kind of a reggae DJ. And I was probably about 15, and I had dabbled in a very couple different names. And Hakeem used to always just say, Drama, Drama. I used to call Bakari that. And, you know, I asked Bakari, I was like, you know, that sounds kind of hot. What you going to do with that? And he was like, you can have it. So I just took the name Drama and used it. And then, you know, throughout my years, I moved to Atlanta in 96, and I just always felt like it was going to be real hard for me to make it with that name Drama, because it was such a common word in the English language. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's my man Trauma, shout out to my man DJ Trauma, who was, you know, in the late 90s was like murdering Atlanta, you
mm-hmm.
know, so I really couldn't go anywhere and tell people my name, because they would be like, oh, DJ Trauma, yeah. Or K-Slay was out at the time, and it was just like, man, this shit ain't going to work with this name, you know? And I used to always try to go here and change it and dramatic and go by my real name, and I would always come back to Drama, to the point where just by the time Gangsta Grills had really taken off, it was DJ Drama, and, you know, here we are.
How did a young man from Philadelphia and end up in Atlanta, Georgia?
Clark Atlanta University. I had came down to visit Atlanta, like, a couple years earlier with my dad, and, you know, it's just something about Atlanta that I felt at that time. You just could, you know, I always thought I was going to wind up in New York. You know, I was like a very East Coast type of guy and what have you, was in love with New York and, you know, always saw myself in the city. And then I came to visit Atlanta, and I came to Clark Atlanta to visit for the school. I remember this was around the time when Busta Rhymes Wu-Ha was on fire. And it was just, you know, you could just feel the energy here, like, you know, young people of color, like, just very affluential and I just, you know, it was a vibe, and I wound up getting my pop was friends with the dean of, I don't know what it was called, dean of admissions, mm-hmm. at the time, and he helped me get a academic scholarship, so it was a no brainer. So I wound up coming to CAU. I met Sense like my first day in Brawley Hall when we got to school. And we had like a little DJ battle, and you know, he was from Philly, I was from Philly, and you know, the couple of friends that we had around, and we clicked. And then, you know, my man Cannon came the next year, and we just, you know, when in Atlanta, I was pretty much just, it was totally about the AUC. Like, I didn't know much about, you know, the city. Like, you know, 112 was foreign, and 559 was foreign, and you know, we were just like college DJs, and you know, but I pretty much just like started really hustling my mixtapes on campus and getting my name up. And
did you DJ at all on the college radio station?
Yeah, we were part of starting the college station at CAU. You know, not that they had a jazz station, but then there, what's it called, WSTU, and we were there when it originally started.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, me and Sense was probably the first two DJs on the station.
To play any hip-hop at all?
To play any hip-hop.
So it was just strictly jazz?
It was jazz. They had WCLK. That's the jazz station.
Okay.
And while we were there, they started STU.
Tell me about the Philadelphia, man, and growing up in Philadelphia, and how that influenced how much of a hustler you are.
I feel like, you know, I always tell people, like, you know, that's the one thing that I feel like I got from Philly more than anything is the hustle, you know? I don't know why it's like that or what it is about, you know, Philly when it comes to that, but you know, just like the kids that were around me at the time or what I was seeing and everything, you know, I was in, it was a good time for hip hop culturally for me. You know, I came up, I watched the Roots get their deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bahamadia was my next door neighbor.
Get out of
here. Yeah, Bahamadia was my next door neighbor in West Philly where my dad lived. So, you know, I watched her kind of, you know, make it. And, you know, we was just, you know, we did it for the love. We did it for the culture. But it taught me the hustle was kind of what pushed me, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like I brought that element with me. I don't know why, you know, Philly's known for the hustling mentality, but we are. And sometimes, you know, I think about it a lot of times because...
And the style mentality, too. There's a lot of style.
A lot of style.
That reaches out around the world that actually started in Philadelphia.
You know, and I even think, like, I used to, you know, try my hand at graffiti, and, you know, in Philly, there's a style called a wicket, you know, which is very... Philly style, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's very known. And, you know, I think, you know, people from Philly, like if you know somebody's from Philly, another Philly person will always be like, they're from Philly. And and we do that a lot. And I don't know if it's, you know, because we feel like we're the little cousin of New York, or we have a chip on our shoulder because sometimes we don't feel like we get, you know, the love that we should and everything. And then specifically being a DJ from Philly, you know, I mean, we were a DJ city, you know what I mean? I come from a city with whether it was Jeff or whether it was Cash Money or Miz or, you know, my man DJ Ghetto, who's, you know, Active's older cousin. Like, you know, he was kind of like a mentor to me at times, and, you know, a very technical city and what have you. So, you know, all that came into play when it came to my career and, you know, how I came up and whether I was studying, like, I would study like the mixtape DJs. I would study the battle DJs. Like, I would listen to DJ Ran and Kobe Kolb and Cosmic Kev on Radioactive. Like, mm-hmm. you know, that really shaped my, you know, early hip hop years.
How old were you when you started DJing, and how did you start DJing?
I was 13. I went to go see the movie Juice. I was going from, you know, eighth grade to ninth grade.
I was in that movie for like a half a second.
You know, here's another tidbit for you. So I'll go on. So I went to go see Juice, and this is crazy. I went to go see Juice, and I was like, I was really into skateboarding. And we had this place called Love Park in Philly, which is, you know, no longer there as far as where the skateboarders go. And I came, when I got there, like when I was in the skateboarding and I would go down to Love Park, it was around a time when a lot of black skateboarders first started coming out. Shout out my man Stevie Williams, who's, you know.
Yeah, big shout out to Stevie Williams, man.
You know, I grew up with Stevie. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, we knew each other. I met Stevie when he was nine, and I was probably 12 or something. And,
wow.
You know, he was, like, impeccable then. So, but I wasn't, everybody around me was better than me. I wasn't that good. So when I saw Juice, and I was like, damn, that shit, you know, that's, I might be able to do that. You know what I mean? That just looks fun, you know? So I convinced my mom to buy me one turntable and a mixer. I got a turntable and a mixer. And we had a store in Philly called Armand's Record, which was at 11th and Filbert. And I used to go buy records. Probably one of the first records I ever bought was the fucking single off Who's the Man soundtrack.
Wow.
And on the B-side was Big Party and Bullshit.
Party and Bullshit.
That was probably one of my
which a lot of people don't know was Big's really official first record. And also
Who's
with a lot
man,
of.
Man, rest in peace, Heavy D. It was
that's right.
Heavy D. It was Heavy D, Who's the Man on the A-side.
Right.
And Big Party and Bullshit was the B-side.
And what a lot of people don't know about that, and rest in peace, Ted Demme, the man who directed Who's the Man for us, and one of the creators of Yom TV Raps, along with Peter Daugherty, they both passed on. What a lot of people don't know is because Dre and I actually wrote the story for Who's the Man, we had to sign off on that whole soundtrack. So it was on us to turn around and give Puff and Andre Harrell that green light to go to add all of those people to that soundtrack.
Wow.
And Big being one of them, man. So you really, really started. That was the foundation
that was it.
You. Because Philly is known for great DJs.
Of course. You know, and I knew I was like, you know, I was hip to some degree, but you know that 92 was when I started. I mean, my first records was Brand New Being Punk, Shove Up to Get Beat Down,
wow,
Super Cat, Ghetto Red Hot, Who's the Man, and those are the first records I remember buying.
Those are the first three records that you remember buying.
So, Curious George, what was that song?
Shout out to Curious George.
I'm curious. Yep.
Yeah, I got to find Curious George because he got some stories to tell, and I would love to interview him. So you make the transition in '96, and you come down to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Once you finished school, were you already pretty much known around all these black college campuses as a DJ?
A little bit, like, you know, we had become like AUC legends at that point. Like, you know, everybody kind of had known when it came to you know, the HBCUs in Atlanta, like Drama, Sense and Canon were those guys, you know what I'm saying? And I was definitely like, I had converted to you know, the tapes turned into CDs and everything. And I had a gig that I had, I was working at Turner for a brief minute, like my senior year. And then you know, when I graduated, they let me go at Turner, and I didn't get a job. Like, you know, I was like, man, I'm gonna just do my thing. And a friend of my father, Dwight Williams, who works with John Singleton, was working on Baby Boy. We were just about to start the movie Baby Boy, and they offered me a PA job, a production assistant. So I was, you know, like, hell yeah, you know, it sounds good. So I went to...
If it's the same Dwight Williams, I believe he worked on Who's the Man also.
It probably is. Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
The same Dwight Williams. He's originally from Philadelphia. My pop had went to, known him for years. They went to high school together.
Right.
So, but around that time, I was really good friends with Kevin Powell. And Kevin Powell was kind of, you know, had always kind of mentored me in a lot of ways. And he was kind of had a managerial role in my career. And he's the first person to ever take me overseas. He was taking me for a gig in London. So I went to L.A. I worked on Baby Boy. You know, PA is basically a paid internship.
Yeah, kind of go for
getting
like
trash, going to Popeyes, doing whatever's needed to be. But, you know, it was a great short experience. You know, I got to see Taraji's first tape when, you know, she got the role, and be around John at the time and what have you. But I had to leave to go to this gig with you know, Kevin in London. So I told him, you know, I got to go. I got to leave for a minute. You know, I'm going to come back. Long story short, I went to go do the gig, and I was like, man, you know, I feel like in the film world, I'm starting at ground zero. You know, it's not like I had an internship at Dre's studio. Mm-hmm. So here I gotta make my name all over again if I'm going to go. Because I technically went to school for film. You know, I kind of had thought that's what I wanted to do. But I was already, you know, kind of doing my DJ thing. So I never went back. And when I got back to Atlanta, you know, I just was like, you know, I'm not going to get a job. I'm going to just, you know, focus on, you know, my career. And since had gotten since
now your pops had went out on a limb for that for you. How did your pops react to you not going back into the film world?
He wasn't tripping. My pop has always been kind of supportive. Like my mom is kind of more. My mom comes from education. Like she's a teacher. So my pop used to look at it like my son has the license to print money. You know, and my pop is kind of so he got it to a sense, you know. So I don't think it was any hard feelings on anybody so forth. And I think people kind of knew, like, you know, I was nowhere near where I was, but it was like, yeah, he's a DJ for a living. So
right.
And
and you had just come back from London getting paid.
Yeah, I just got back from DJ. London. My first time overseas ever was, you know, at the time. And then, you know, I came back to Atlanta and I started on my mixtape hustle, you know, outside of being at school. And I had already, when I was in school, you know, I used to like set up a table on campus and just, you know, kind of hustle my tapes. People like, who's DJ Drama? And I'd be like, I don't know, I just work for him.
He
told me to be here, you know, right. So I'm just selling his tapes. And I would make like, I would have like a reggae tape. I would have a South tape. I would have a East Coast tape. I would have a Neo Soul tape. I would just have a spectrum of projects, whatever anybody needed. And, you know, I would do it that way. And this guy, Marco from Tape Masters, told me at the time, you know, like we had started Gangsta Grills, and he was like, yo, you on to something with that. Like, that's a niche. Like, that's because I couldn't compete, you know, with what was going on up top, you know, and I was trying to, mm-hmm. but, you know, it was, you know, I couldn't compete with Slay and Clue and Greenland and Who Kid at the time. Like, but when it came to the South, it was, you know, something, it was something that I was getting the music first.
Where did that name Gangsta Grills come from?
Me and Sense were...
Sense, come in and get on this mic, man, because Sense is in the building, too. Sense, give me the backstory on Gangsta Grills, bro.
Shout out my man, Empress Cersei. I used to intern... Actually, I interned at 107.9.
Okay.
When we was in... Still Hot 97. Yeah, when it was Hot 97.5 back then. And I was Cersei's intern when he was the afternoon guy. And... you know, we came up with this tape. Remember, what was it called?
How the South Was Won.
Okay.
We called ourselves the Young Guns.
We was the Young Guns.
Yeah, we called ourselves the Young Guns.
Hilarious.
And then Drum was like, oh, no, we saw.
This is why this shit is hilarious. Because I used to have Young Guns right here on my arm because my man Stretch, they used to run with Tupac real, real close, who was in the Live Squad.
Yep.
There,
I know Stretch.
Yeah, big Stretch. There, his crew, his outside crew, little homies with the YGs, the Young Guns.
Wow,
crazy. Yeah, that's crazy.
That's crazy. So, no, remember we went to Birthday Bash.
Well, we had Empress Cersei offered us a tape. He offered to pay for us to have a table at Birthday Bash.
This okay,
remember? No, shout out to Jelly because we saw Jelly. Remember when? That's when Jelly
he murdered us. Yeah, they killed us.
They was killing the mixtape game in the South.
Yeah, right. They were the mixtape game in the South.
Big shout out to DJ Jelly.
Yeah,
and then so Drum was like, man, you see, we gotta get some money. Like the next Birthday Bash, let's get a stand. So I told Cersei, and Cersei kind of saw what we had going on, and he gave us like $500.
He gave us $1,000.
He gave us $1,000. He gave us money to print up the tapes.
Yep.
Right.
And then Drum was like, remember, we had a whole bunch of tapes, though. Yeah. Drum was like, but this Birthday Bash, we got to have a soft tape. And he was like, Gangsta Grill. He was, Gangsta Grills. And I said, that's it.
Oh, wow.
And then that was it.
That was how I started.
What was the first, do y'all remember, did y'all have any special?
Nothing.
On the first Gangsta Grills?
No.
Listen, Eric Sermon Music was on. That was the biggest.
Just Like Music.
That was the biggest song on there.
Are you kidding me?
Just Like
Music. Shake It Fast. No, that's not right.
What, Young
Yeah,
Bloods?
Shake It Fat. No. Wasn't Shake It Fast on there?
Was it?
It was.
I don't remember. We spelled it with an S. It was Gangsta Grills with an S. It was a picture of somebody with a gold grills.
Yep.
Right.
Because, and then what happened was we did that one together. Then I did a part two, and then this was around the time when everybody was kind of, you know, getting hosts. Like that mm-hmm. was what was hot up top. Was hosts on mixtapes, and Puff was hosting tapes, and mm-hmm. you know, whoever was big at the time. And I was like, damn, I need to get a host for the tape. And I asked like three different people who were big at the time, and two of them kind of declined.
Who were? Who are they? You can tell.
I forget one.
It's a podcast.
I forget one of them. The other one, was Baby D.
Okay.
Baby D
was on fire.
Yeah. Baby D was on fire. Yeah. And Baby D basically, you know, looking back on it, I understand respectfully he didn't want to do it because he was part of Big Oomph. And
that's,
you know,
exactly why
it was kind of like for him it might have been some conflict. He
right,
and
Big
Oomph
had mad record stores.
That was
yeah.
I mean, that's what Jelly Monte. They all came under the Big Oomph, you know, umbrella. And then, you know, I asked Little John. I was like, "Can you host a tape?" And he was like, "Sure." You know, so he came to the crib, and you know, I had told him it was Gangsta Grillz 4. I don't know why, but I forgot I never did a 3. And then he did the drops for the tape, and that's hence how the Gangsta Grillz.
But tell him how the whole Lil Jon thing came together.
Well, I met
with Cersei.
Yeah, I met Lil Jon because I came to visit you at the station.
Yeah, and then it's funny because we didn't even know Jon even knew what we was doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jon just like salutes Drama.
Yeah,
like
goes like this to me the first time I meet him, and I'm like, I'm DJ Drama, you're fucking Little John. Like,
right.
But he showed love. And then, you know, the next tape. So that was the first tape I had with the host. And, you know, Little John hosted it. It was my first tape I got. It was in the Source at the time. And, you know, I was hype. And the next time it was time to. That was when my man Marco from Tape Masters was telling me, like, yo, stay on this. Like, you're on to something.
Right.
And the next tape, I didn't have a host. So I was like, I'm just going to use John's voice again. And it kind of, you know, I started to really realize and started to focus on the fact that I was building a brand, you know, that was even kind of, you know, besides people knowing who DJ Drama was, people were getting familiar with Gangsta Grillz. And,
right.
You know, the style that was popular in the South was like, they don't want to hear no talking. They don't want to hear no new music. Like, they don't, you know, stick to the hits and just, you know, blends and mix. And we kind of went against the grain. And I was taking everything that everybody was doing up top and applying it to Southern music.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which everybody was telling me was not going to work. And I started talking shit on the tapes and, you know, putting drops and getting Killer Mike and T.I. freestyles early and putting this shit out there. And it caught on. Like, everything that people were saying they don't want to hear in the South, they did.
Right.
Tell them about the time when Tip first came to the crib.
Tip,
tell them about that crib we had.
So we had a little. We had a little duplex. It was like basically like a little shack off Glen Iris. What's that name? What's it called now? The new Fourth Ward.
It's Fourth Ward.
Yeah.
Old Fourth Ward.
It's called Old Fourth Ward. It used to just be called Fourth Ward. And Coach K lived around the corner from us.
That's a whole nother story.
That's how we met Coach K. I got a phone call randomly. You know, I was putting little tapes out, and phone rang, and he called me and said, "Yo, my name's Jason Jeter. You know, I have this new artist. His name is T.I. We just signed a deal with LaFace. You know, he's got a record with Beanie Siegel." That's how he sold it to me. He said, "He's got a record with Beanie Siegel."
That's that Philly connection,
right?
Right.
So, and I didn't, you know, looking back, it's so crazy because the way, you know how it is now, Ed, like, you know, with social media, like my phone, the mass of people saying, "Please listen to my music." Jason Jeter called me. He was like, "I got a new artist. I wanted to have him come through and freestyle for you." So I was like, "Yeah, all right, cool. Come through." I told Sense, you know, this guy called me. He's coming through. So Jason and Tip walked in. Tip was still wearing his little bifocals at the time. Very quiet and, you know, very reserved. Didn't do much talking. And we went where I would make Gangsta Grillz was pretty much where people in that crib where people had their laundry. Had the washer and dryer machine.
Okay.
Tip came in the room. I put on Jay-Z and a Mill for the fan beat, and he started spitting. And, you know, during the rap, he said he was the king of the South. And, you know, so I, you know.
Don't nobody even know who he is, though.
Yeah, wow. Never heard of him day in my life.
And he's saying he's the king of the South.
King of the South. So I'm listening to him, da da da. Yo, appreciate you, my bro. Good looking. They left. I said, yo, since this nigga just came in here and said he was the king of the South.
I'll never forget
He's
that.
He's tripping. So you know, that was how my relationship with Tip and Jason started. And around that same time, you know, Coach K lived around the corner from us, and you know, he used to have this group called Jadis that he used to always bring us music from and everything. And he was like, yo, I'm working with this new guy named Young Jeezy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they used to have this Come Shop With Me was the name of his album before our mixtapes. And he had this van, this Come Shop With Me van. And and they used to do shows. Jeezy used to do shows in Macon. So Coach K would bring him to this crib, you know, the crib that Little John's been through. T.I.,
so
everybody came through this little hut we had, and I would make Jeezy like show tapes. He would give me like $100. I would make his little show tapes for him. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I first met T.I., I was down here. I don't remember what I was in Atlanta for, but I remember walking around the corner, and it was something to do with music, and this dude walked up to me, and he said, hey, Ed Lover, how you doing? My name is Tip. Everybody, and he was so polite, yeah. And that's the reason why I remember him out of everybody, because you know you run into a lot of people and they be like, yo, this is my man, he's ill, his name is whatever, you're going to hear about us. And I can remember that this dude was, first thing that struck me, he was so small, and then he was so fucking polite. And he kept going, he was like, you know, I just signed on the face, I got an album coming out, man, you know, I just wanted to say hello to you, I enjoy what you do, you know, a lot of respect to you, and you're going to hear from me very soon, just, you know, my name is Tip, but I think they're going to make me call myself T.I. because of Q-Tip.
Yep, Tip was,
and I was like, wow, okay, you know what I mean? And I just remember years later, when I just remember how polite and reserved he was for somebody that was a rapper.
Yeah.
You know, it was crazy, so... Coach K is around the corner. He's bringing you stuff. So you got Little John coming through, T.I. coming through. Mm-hmm. Gangsta Grills at this time is starting to really pick up steam.
It was still early. I was still moving them myself a lot.
Okay.
Like I was going to CAU, Spelman, Georgia State, hustling CDs. I would start calling, like, you know, all the stores on the East Coast, like, hey, my name is DJ Drama. I have this, you know, Southern mixtape, and stores would be like, yo, nobody's really checking for South music like that. And I was like, listen, I'm going to just send you a box, you know, check it out, take it for free, let me know how they do. So stores started hitting me back like, yo, they, you know, those things started, you know, they were moving, like, we need a couple more. And I would just go to, like, you know, how New York has Canal Street, Atlanta has kind of like the flea markets and what have you. And I would go in the flea markets and start kind of just moving CDs myself. We did like Gangsta Grill 6 with Killer Mike, Bone Crusher, and David Banner. And that CD, you know, that was still at a time when it was like, Gangsta Grills was still a compilation. It was just like, it was just the hottest songs out. And it had everything on it. And I remember I went to the Bootleggers, and it was just like, this was around the time when Get Rich or Die Trying was out. And I seen like a mass amount of bootlegs of my tape. And I was excited, like, oh, nigga, I made it. Like, they bootlegging me, you know what I'm saying? And then I was like, oh my God, they're making way more money than I'm making. You know, but I was just hyped to see it. And then what happened was I got another call from Jason Jeter, and he was like, listen, man, you know, I want to do something special where it's like just all T.I. and PSC and Grand Hustle. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. I'm with that. And that tape that was the first Gangsta Grill that was like kind of what became the street album, which was all T.I. and all PSC and Grand Hustle music.
So T.I. was the very first one.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's backtrack a little bit. You said when you were doing Gangsta Grills before, up to number 6, it was a compilation of all the hottest music. Where was this music coming from? How were you acquiring this music? Because that's one thing about Clue. When Clue was dropping mixtapes, and we would go crazy for Clue tapes, Clue had shit nobody else had. He always was the first. He also was the first with the new Jay-Z, the first with the new Beanie, the first. How were you getting this music?
I mean, we were pretty connected with like with the labels.
Artists started giving it to us.
Yeah, they started giving it to us around that time. So, but the different, there was still a difference, because you got to think like the Clue at the time, and you know me moving forward, I got to that point, but we didn't have to be that ahead of the curve because, you know, again, they just wanted the hottest records out. So, you know, here's a compilation with TI-24s, David Banner Like a Pimp, Bone Crusher Never Scared, you know, which were still kind of on the cusp of where they were as far as the rest of the country goes. You
okay.
know what I mean? So,
and you talking shit on these mixtapes, though.
That was the when did I start on 6? I don't know if I talked. 6 might have been the first tape we talked on. Hmm. Yeah, I think that was the first. Before that, I had never said nothing on the tapes.
Okay,
and it's so crazy.
Mixing.
And just to go to backtrack, too, you know, because, like, it's like I didn't really talk a lot on the mixtapes till about that. But I had this teacher at school tell me one time, like, yo, your voice is special. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, and I just looking back on it and how much I feel like, you know, my personality and my voice has played a part in my career and those projects. You know, it wasn't till then till I really kind of got a gist of it. And I still didn't learn how important I would be to a couple years later, hence when the Jeezy movement. But we were in the know a little bit, so we were getting a lot of the music directly from the people and everything. Like, you know, David Banner would come see me and things of that nature.
Right, and so just that, drop off music to you guys because they knew that y'all were on to something and it was starting to move.
Right, but I will say it wasn't necessarily till that first Tip tape where I did a project where you couldn't get none of that music unless you had that Gangsta Grills.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like, you know, before that, you know, we were putting together good projects, but you had choices of where to get that. When the Tip Gangsta Grills first came out, that was all Tip, you had to get that tape to get that. Like,
yeah.
That's when people started saying, oh, okay, we got to check for this.
Like, yeah, and it really started moving. Like, it moved,
started moving
retardedly, and it was all up in New York, and, right. and everybody yep. had it, and it was like, yo, look at what dude is doing.
Yep.
Like, real. You changed the mixtape game for dudes in New York
right.
to follow suit to what y'all was doing.
Right, real.
You know, at first, y'all gave the South a little bit of what we were doing, but mm-hmm. once you started that, and it was all T.I., and it was shit that we didn't hear before, it was now like all the New York DJs started having to grab somebody. Well, let me get an all Fab joint.
Right.
Let me do this whole joint with Mano. Let me do this whole 50 Cent joint. Like, y'all really seriously changed the game.
I credit
50 and Dipset.
I credited the 50, definitely 50 and Dipset. Like, when I did the Tip tape, I remember after I did it, I felt like, okay, Tip gave me the opportunity to do what I wanted. I was emulating what Green and Who Kid mm-hmm. and 50 was doing. Like, to
right.
me, 50 is, there was a pre-Fifth mixtape game and then there's the post-50 mixtape game. So, you know, I come after that in that lineage. And then, you know, when what we did with Gangsta Grill started to, you know, then turn into something else. Because you're right, like, outside of us, like,
Who Kid and probably a few others. That's
Who Kid was
it.
On? Who Kid was still in, like, we was looking at Who Kid shit like, this shit's amazing.
We did. Like, Green Lantern.
Yeah, Green and Who
Green.
Kid were our fucking idols. Like,
right.
shout out to my niggas, Who Kid and Green. And then, you know, but outside of us, you know, the South mixtape world was in the South. Mm-hmm. You know, I was calling stores and coming to New York and trying to get my shit everywhere to for it to be everywhere. Like, you know, I really still feel like, you know, it's because of the dedication, you know, and what that CD did in New York that people started to really pay attention to how lyrical Lil Wayne was. And,
right.
You know.
Definitely. Oh, absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Was there any backlash from the native ATLians, because you two dudes are from Philly.
100%.
Like, these, how do y'all gonna let these Philly motherfuckers
definitely
come 100%. In here?
A lot of that.
It was a lot of that, but I also feel like there was a lot of embracement. You know, I mean, Atlanta's the type of city where a lot of, you know, there's a lot of migration. So, you know, a lot of people aren't necessarily from here. But early on, there was, you know, there was some of that where it was like, you know,
why y'all fucking with them? Y'all should be fucking with us. We're from here. We're the supporters.
Absolutely.
We're your backbone. We've been here. They just came here from Philly
right.
to go to school. Now they're stealing our swag and it's all of this.
All of that.
Yeah.
For a long time, Big Oop wouldn't carry Gangsta Grills. Matter of fact, Gangsta Grills was probably the first non-Big Oop mixtape that he wound up carrying in the store.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So y'all went through it.
We did. I mean, you know, which is, you know, it's
at the height of your gangster grills of you guys and everything y'all was doing. You know, Trendsetter was putting out shit. Cannon was putting out shit. You putting out shit. People are eating this shit up. How many mixtapes do you think you were moving? Because once you got gangster grills, you had to go back and catalog your shit.
It was thousands. I mean,
it was hundreds of thousands.
Definitely. Like,
I remember I knew it changed when we had that office, the first office. And you couldn't move. It was just boxes everywhere.
Yeah, it was.
It was like we was really like.
It was crazy. It was a distribution system.
It was a real distribution system going out. Did y'all have to hire people to get?
We had staffed.
18 people staffed.
Yeah, we had a lot of people.
And we like 23, 24 years old.
Yeah. Wow. Moving that many mixtapes.
Uh-huh. I mean, the money, it was crazy. It was a different time. Like, you know, it was new to me too.
Right. Did you go bonkers a little bit?
You know, I didn't really. I've learned a valuable lesson to not just let money sit in the bank. That's what I had learned at the time. You know, because I had never, you know, I come from like a middle class family where I never had a lot of money, but came from a broke background. So when I got money, I just wanted to sit there and I wanted to look at it. You know, so when they came and raided us and they took all the money, I was like, damn, if I'd have did something with it, it wouldn't have just been sitting there like that.
Right.
So what did I do? We had some nice cars and stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't go too crazy.
I can say though, Dron was popping and he still was living in that house. He was the last one to move out the house.
You moved out first? Out first?
Only because
I did. And
because I was on the road with Tip.
That's right.
I was on the road with Tip, so I didn't have time to move.
But you had a Benz, though.
You had the Benz
in that low-ass house.
Since remember that shit.
But the money just, once it hit, like I remember once I got to talk to my man Jason Brown, too. It had worked for me at the time. And, you know, he kind of helped put the system together. And it just started escalating. It was going from the Tip tapes to Jeezy, and it was like Gangsta Grills was the hottest shit on the block. It was crazy.
It was the hottest shit in America.
Right.
What was the gist of the FBI raid on you guys? What did they say they were trying to accomplish by that?
I mean,
because we was wearing Free Drama T-shirts back then.
Right. Appreciate that. You know, the story goes like there was a kiosk in the mall what mall was that? It was in
Morrow.
What mall was out there?
South Lake. My daughter works there right now, so I know. Shout out to my daughter Tiffany.
South Lake Mall. It was a kiosk in the mall, and it was near it was close to Peppermint Music, and I guess Peppermint complained about the kiosk because she was selling CDs, so they called the cops on her. And when the cops came to see her, she was like, "No, these tapes are good. Like, I get these from DJ Drama. Like, these are all legal. Like, it's no problem." So I guess from that, I guess the Morrow police went and called the RIAA and let them know, "Hey, you know, this happened," and you know. She said we get them from this guy named DJ Drama. So we had a website, gangstagrills.com, at the time. And, you know, we had the office. And it sounds like or it seemed like they started staking out the office. And, you know, just they went to the website and bought a couple CDs and got them sent to them and what have you. And, you know, I guess from other music raids that were happening, because it was kind of – those things were happening a lot in Atlanta where, like, you know, bootleggers were getting raided and they would find, like, bags and fake shoes and all that shit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they thought we was probably on the same shit. So when they came for us, you know, and they were staking out the office and what have you, and they, you know, they rolled up and they came fully armed and, you know.
How many deep, Sense? How many deep? Were you in the office at the time?
Yeah, he was there.
How many deep?
Man, they thought we had some key personnel here.
Yeah, this is a podcast.
They thought we had some shit. They brought the dogs in.
They definitely thought we had some shit.
It was. They brought a whole squad in.
Yeah, M16s, everything. Yeah. You know,
everybody lay down.
Everybody lay down. Where's
like
the
you're
drugs?
A drug dealer.
Yeah. Where's the guns?
Yeah. Where's the money?
And God bless that they came on a Monday morning because they didn't find a fucking spliff. we come from, you never know who might have a pistol on them or a bag, something. Yeah. Like, they didn't find nothing but CDs.
Right.
And what was so crazy at the time, too, was I was doing an interview for the New York Times magazine, and the woman doing the interview, you know, was just really trying to get into the mixtape business. And you know, mixtape business is always it's a fine line, but it's something unspoken about. It's for promotional use only.
Right.
So she started asking me all these random questions and about the business, and it just was weird time. And so at the time when it all went down, you know, it was a lot of conspiracy theories and people saying, you know, this person told, or the music business is going through a tough time and we want to make an example out of drama. And it was really crazy how the game changed. Like, I look at all my peers who were around me at the time, from K-Slay to Clinton Sparks to so many people who have so many other ventures going on now, mm-hmm. who were all at that time just about mixtapes, you know, but it was like they knock drama in them. Oh, it's rap. Like, this shit's done. It's over.
I remember being in Who Kid's apartment, and he had duplication machines.
Crazy.
He had about 20 duplication machines, and he was just duplicating, just running. It's running and running, because at that time, like you guys, Who Kid was selling mixed CDs all over the world.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, the amount of mixtapes that were requests that were coming in from him from different places around the world was like, it was mind-blowing that this dude, you know, was just really at the beginning of G-Unit and what was going on. But before that, Who Kid was just making money, hand over fist, just mixtape.
He's a marketing genius. I mean, I definitely salute to him for really pushing the culture forward outside of just the music, just the visually what he did for mixtapes. And, you know, he was the first person with the fold outs.
We definitely studied Who Kid.
Big shout out to Who Kid. You know, with his sponsorships. Yep. He had MTV logos on his shit and everything. So, those guys were salute.
How did you guys get from up under that whole federal thing to get back to where you are and where you are now?
Hard work, you know. I mean, I just felt like.
Because I have never seen anybody else go up against the feds and come out smelling all right.
You know, just hard work, really. And, you know.
It was a blessing, man.
Yeah, it was. It was definitely a blessing. And, you know, we had a good team of us, you know, seeing that we were friends first. Like, you know, we were doing this. We used to split fucking $150, like $200.
Right.
And DJ for 6 hours, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, to that point in our careers in that year, 10 years ago, you know, to see where we had gotten, it was just like, you know, we had each other to really push each other forward and be like, yo, you know, this ain't it. Like, you know, this is gonna make us bigger. And
was it a square one rebuild?
We wound up getting some of it back.
Okay.
We had a couple different accounts. And the account that I had, they kept the majority of the money that was in, like, my DJ Drama account, because they said they couldn't tell the difference on what money was what. Then we had, ironically, you know, through my Atlantic Records deal, they had frozen that account, but they wound up giving that back. So, you know, and at the time I was signed to Atlantic through Grand Hustle, and I hadn't put out my first album, and the label got excited, like, whoa, this is great publicity. Like, you're on fire. Let's put the record out, you know?
Right.
So, and I remember even that same year I had went to Super Bowl was in Miami, and I went down there, and, you know, people knew me before that, like, you know, definitely in hip hop world and hip hop culture. But I could tell the difference on the type of attention that I was getting, and I felt like, oh, this might work out in my favor. You know,
right.
When Billboard called and wanted to put me on the cover, by that point, we was like, oh, we running with this. Like,
yeah, so it worked out in your favor.
Worked out in our favor.
Yeah, absolutely. So your first album with Atlantic approached you, or did Jason G to say, hey, let's do this?
I had gotten to the point where Gangsta Grillz was so hot that I had various offers from various labels to do an album deal at the time. And, you know, I feel like, you know, those years, there hadn't been anybody since Clue and Flex who had been that hot, you know what I'm saying, to do albums. And me and Khaled kind of got our deals around the same time. And I went to Atlantic because, you know, one, I was definitely loyal to Grand Hustle, and I had kind of known their system, and, you know, so yeah, they kind of approached me and offered me the deal.
Okay, Craig Kalman and Julie Greenwald.
Craig was there.
Kaiser was there.
Kaiser had just got the whole Def Jam Regime had just kind of gotten there. So Julia had came over, Kaiser was there, Kev had just gotten there, and so forth. So, you know, I felt like, you know, I was also in the company of greatness, you know, so I wanted to be over
Tell me about you guys' mindset going into that first album, because it's different when you're getting songs from people.
Right.
And it's different when you're,
right,
you know, when somebody says, here's some new material, here's some freestyles, put this all together, make this a Gangster Grillz. Now you have to produce an album.
It was tough. It was that, like, I felt like I was trying to put everything all into one. You know, that first album is like, you want to take all your ideas and everything you can and put it into one. Like, I remember that album had like 20 songs on it. I wish I would have saved a couple, you know. But
right.
But I was just, it was, you know, it was something new. Like you said, like, you know, it's one thing for people to give you records and, you know, and put together a mixtape. Like, here we are trying to paint a canvas, you know. But it was fun. It was interesting. It was hard. You know, I ran into realizing how much clearance is and whole world, what you got to do for that. But, you know, I had a song with Outkast on my first album, which was like,
fire.
You know, just like for me, it was like, nigga, I got an Outkast record at
right.
a time when Outkast wasn't even doing records like that. So, you know, it was some shit on there. Like, I was proud of it. I was very proud of it.
Your job in putting that album together is to produce the entire record or to line up the producers you want to work with?
Line up the producers and line up the records and kind of, you know, be the overseer somewhat. So
right.
Cannon had a lot of production on that album. But we all, you know, we all pretty much, you know, played a role in helping put it together.
Right.
You know, one of the song, what was supposed to be the first single was Cannon with the Lil Wayne record, which had come from Dedication 2 mixtape. And then we did Feds Taking Pictures, which was, you know, which I feel like Atlantic dropped the ball on, you know, seeing what was going on at the time for me and everything. Jeezy, Tip, Ross, Young Buck, Jim Jones,
yep.
And Will was on there.
Yep.
Yep. And then the Outkast record. I was supposed to do an Outkast mixtape before Idlewild. They came to me to do a Gangsta Grillz.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Blue Williams was still managing them.
Shout out to Blue.
And the tape wound up not happening due to time restraints. So they wound up calling me on the phone. Three Stacks, Big, and Blue, and it was like, look, Drum, you know, sorry we didn't get the tape done, but how about if we give you a song for your album? And I was like, hell yeah. Let's do it. You know, easier said than done. You
right.
know what I'm saying? So next thing you know, I'm trying to chase Andre down. You know, I send him beats from Swizz. I send him Manny Fresh beats. I send him Just Blaze beats. And it was just like nothing was sticking. And then Cannon had made me this beat that I had just did this Jim Jones mixtape. And I was told Cannon, yo, I need a beat like that. He made me a beat. Then the raid happened. The next day, I called my man Lake Show, who was managing Marsha Ambrosius at the time. And I was like, yo, see if Marsha can do this hook. Because I was, you know, feeling like nobody can stop us. We still going. Like, let's do it. Marsha did the hook for me. I sent it to 3000. He was like, give me 24 hours. He sent it back. And that's how that record was born.
Wow. Yeah. So out of all the other stuff you sent him, he wasn't feeling it.
I don't know. I want to say he wasn't feeling it, but it didn't. He didn't do anything on it.
Okay.
So I don't want none of them guys to feel that type of way. Because they were all great beats.
Right, yeah. right. And because it's difficult, you know what I mean? A lot of that stuff happens behind the scenes in the music business.
And it's tough, you know, when you do a DJ album, you got, like, you know, you have 40 artists and 15 producers and, you know, like, you want to be fair, like, with people's fees and, you know, and it's not easy putting them albums together.
Yeah,
you know?
I bet. Yeah. I bet that you want to feed everybody's ego. That's a lot of fucking egos to be dealing with. How do you figure out of all that stuff that you get, what makes the cut of your album and what doesn't?
Some of it was just, you know, some things don't get cleared and some you just, you know, you put your life on the line and just a lot of phone calls. And, you know, it's so crazy because you sign to a major label And then you find yourself making all the phone calls. I remember that. Like, yo, I'm signed to the label. Like, why am I having to call all these people? But, you know, it's just the name of the game. And, you know what I'm saying? Thankfully, you know, I have relationships, and it also helped me build relationships by doing that.
Let's talk about what you got going on with Generation Now. Tell me about Uzi Vert and how you found him and what about him that captured your imagination or made you want to work with this dude.
Generation Now was actually a mixtape title that we coined in like 2004. It was a tape Kanye hosted before College Dropout came out. And, you know, we held on to the title. And I guess, you know, I did two albums over at Atlantic, and then I departed from Atlantic. And
amicably.
We departed, you know, and they let me go, and it was cool. You know, I also think they felt like, you know, the DJ album thing was kind of hard, and I didn't even know if I wanted to do records, and I wound up in the studio with Roscoe Dash and Drummer Boy, and we were working on some stuff, and I wound up coming out with this record called Oh My, which had Wiz Khalifa and Fab on it. And I did that record and started gaining some steam. I wound up getting a deal over at E1, E1/Koch. Shout out to Alan Grumblack.
Shout out to Alan, used to be the head of Relativity, gave me and Dre a deal over there. Big shout out to him.
Over there. So I wound up going over there, but I still wound up using all the same people, you know, that I was working with at Atlantic to do various things, whether it was the videos or whether it was mix shows or what have you. So long story short, I did my albums over at E1. I did the one that Omai was on. Then I did my next album, Quality Street Music. And this record called My Moment was on there, which was my biggest record at the time. 2 Chainz, Jeremiah, and Meek Mill. And my man Crespo used to tell me, like, you know, you should try this A&R thing, you know, see about, you know, you're putting these records together. So he put a bug in Craig Kalman's ear, and I wound up coming back over to Atlantic. You know, they offered me a situation at the time. Cannon was a vice president over at Def Jam. I was building Mean Street Studios. And, you know, there was some artists that I felt like I had just missed out on, you know.
Namely?
Migos.
Okay.
Took Migos to go meet with Allen.
Migos came across your desk?
Definitely. Yeah. The check that Allen had offered them was not big enough.
Okay.
But, you know, we was rocking. Like, you know, I was fucking with them. And my man Pat had brought them to me, Certified Pat, you know. And so... yeah, Migos came across my desk. Tory Lanez, you know, we tried to do that. This kid named T Fly, who wound up, I think, signed with Epic. So, long story short, I felt like, listen, man, like, we keep missing out on these artists, so we got to do this. And I had started my job over at Atlantic. You know, Mean Streets was being built. Cannon came. I remember we were in here one time, and he was like, yo, I was in Philly. This kid, Lil Uzi, I heard it on the radio, and I just was like, let's do it. Never heard it.
Never heard him.
And didn't hear a lick. I was just like, run it. Because, you know, I trust Cannon's ear, and I just know I didn't want to miss out on anything else. Like, I had been right there for so many things, and I had felt like that was part of my career, that it was one of the things I hadn't accomplished yet. You know, somebody coming. You know, we had been part of so many mixtapes and watched so many artists flourish, you know what I'm saying, which is a great feeling, but it's like, these guys got big, and we were part of these careers, you know, and you know, we definitely benefited as well. So,
but didn't benefit in the long run on it.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, you know, here we are at Mean Street Studios.
So there was some benefit. Yeah, absolutely.
I definitely feel like it was benefits on all terms, regardless. But so I wound up. Cannon told us about Uzi. I said, Rock, let's do it. You know, he started a relationship. I was on tour with Wiz Khalifa in 2014, and Wiz Khalifa, Jeezy, a couple other people, and we were in Jersey. Uzi came to the show, and he came on a bus, and he made like some smart ass comment to me first time he met me, and I was like, yo. But looking back and knowing it, I liked that, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because I could tell, you know, he wasn't like kind of, you know, it didn't matter to him that he was talking to DJ Drama. He was cracking a joke. So, you know, hence that's how I first met him. And, you know, the music, we started to hear the music. And at the time when I was at Atlantic, you know, they were kind of, I was still figuring out the role that I was, you know, given as an A&R, and certain projects were coming across my desk that just didn't, you know, it didn't gel. And I basically told them, like, yo, this is Kid Lil Uzi. Let us do this. Give us this. Let us work our magic. Do how we do best. And boom. And they were like, look, we're going to give you Uzi. Do your thing. Focus on that, and let's see how it goes.
Okay, so they didn't make you work on all the other shit that you didn't
They tried. With. they tried to make to do it. It just didn't gel the same way.
Yeah, they're like, we're giving you a check. This is what we want you to do.
Yeah, and it was, you know, they were looking at Mean Streets like, you know, what's going on, you know, and it was in a year's time, it was like a whole 180 within the system when they were like, yo, Mean Streets is amazing, Uzi's popping, and you know, and looking back on it, like I tell the story, like. And just how the game works, you know, I remember being in an A&R meeting and, you know, they're like, listen, okay, Drum, you know, Uzi's from Philly, you know, you got him out in Atlanta, but, you know, we need him hot in Philly. Like, the way hip-hop works is you got to be hot in your backyard before you blow up. Like, that's just how it goes. And I was like, I don't agree. Like, that's the old formula. Like, that's not right anymore. Like, the internet changed all that. J. Cole wasn't hot in Fayetteville.
That's right. Not at all.
And like, Wiz Khalifa wasn't the man in Pittsburgh, per se, before he was. Drake wasn't. It wasn't because of Toronto. You know, it was the internet. Like, fucking, you know, and I'd used various examples. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it was, and I used that example for Uzi. Like, I don't necessarily think we have to make Uzi hot in Philly first for him to be where he is. And, you know, I was able to prove them, you know, prove them wrong. You know what I'm saying? And I'm sure they're happy about that.
How did you build Uzi from the time that you guys, Cannon first got him?
We took him on tour. I took him on the Boys of Summer tour with Wiz Khalifa and Fall Out Boy. And he had did a record with Carnage, called What Do You Want, which was originally his record that he gave to Carnage.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to really buzz. And a lot of Uzi's original, like, buzz started in L.A. because, you know, that's where we did a majority of our gigs out in L.A. where we worked. So we would play him a lot out there. And then, you know, he was also creating his own, you know, fan base and just kind of, you know, his own relationships with ASAP early, and, you know, him being in Mean Streets. I mean, you know, he met Thug here, like, you know, before Uzi was recording in the B Room, Thug was in the B Room. So,
right.
You know, we took him to South by Southwest in 2015. I kind of felt like that was the coming out party. And then after that, we moved him down here and we just kept working. We just worked it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't hurt to have a studio where everybody's recording out of.
It's a great,
it's a great
additive.
It's a great additive, a great meeting place.
Absolutely.
What do you look for? If there's an artist that's listening to this podcast right now, what do you guys look for in an artist?
You know, I don't know. I'm one to believe that, you know, that there's no book to this. Like, you know,
if there was, everybody would be famous.
Exactly. Like, it's like, you know, if we all could make... If it was that easy to make a hit record, that I'd have them in my back pocket. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I don't know if I look for anything. Like, I just, you know, I think timing is special. I think, you know, I just inspiration. Like, I don't know. I don't know if I look for anything. Like, the other day, I remember I was in Houston, and these kids came up to me. And we were at a Lil Wayne party, and they just were like, yo, can we rap for you, Drama? And it's like, as soon as they came to me, I just had this vision of the New Edition story when Boyz II Men walked over to Michael Bivins, and I was
right.
Like, yes, rap for me. So, you know, I don't, like, it's, sometimes I tell people a lot of times, you know, if you're doing your thing, I'll come to you before you need to come to me, you know?
Okay.
Because I just feel like, you know, so many outlets, and it's so, the game has changed so much where you can accomplish so much without needing a record label or a manager or any of those things. Like, you can go to SoundCloud and create your own fan base. So.
Right. And build that fan base
build
up.
That fan base.
If you're serious and you're dedicated to what you're doing. Since, has anything ever came across your desk, or you guys' desk, that you remember that y'all said, nah, and then the shit blew up?
I mean, shit. We didn't know the Young Jeezy shit was going to work.
Really?
When it first came.
Nah. Jeezy.
It was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It was ahead of time. But I give Dron credit for that because he went ahead and rocked with it anyway and did the mixtape.
Right.
And then it turned out to be a blessing on that.
I don't know a lot of that stuff. I didn't know the Wayne tape was going to do that either. Like,
but you kind of felt the Wayne, like you.
I did, but I never knew. I didn't know it was going to be that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because like, Wayne, he hadn't been that. Like, he was doing the Squad Up tapes.
Yeah.
But Jeezy sat me down and was like, listen, I got a vision. Like, this is my vision, and this is what we're going to do. And, you know, I had never done, before Jeezy, I had never done a tape with, like, Tip was kind of already, you know, he was known in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But there was nobody, like, Jeezy was the first new artist on the Gangsta Grills. Like, mm-hmm. There had been no new artist. So when his tape came out, Gangsta Grills was bigger, way bigger than Young Jeezy. Like, they wouldn't say, yo, this is the new Jeezy Gangsta Grills. They'd be like, this is the new Gangsta Grills. So
right.
Jeezy had that vision, and I was going along with the ride. And when it, you know, when it hit, it was like, it hit. And I was like, okay, this is special. Like, this is special.
Yeah, this guy's voice, first of all, his voice alone was special, right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was like his own style, his own lane. There wasn't too many people in that lane at that time.
That era, that time period, that was the whole, the BMF, the whole, that whole Atlanta was just, and we was DJing all those parties, all those clubs.
Right.
That shit felt like New Jack City.
Right, because like, it was.
And then because that was absolutely soundtrack was. For it.
Yeah.
So that shit, that time, that era was crazy.
Yeah, so now it's Mean Streets, it's Lil Uzi Vert, it's Generation Now. What's next? What the fuck haven't y'all done that y'all want to do?
That's still a lot.
Got a lot of things.
Yeah, score a film, maybe? Since definitely. You did start out in film.
You know, films.
That's in the making.
You know, Grammys.
Yep.
You don't have a Grammy?
No, I got a shout out the other day.
Who shouted you out on the Grammy?
Chance the Rapper.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, he shouted me out. That was pretty cool. It's a lot. I don't like, just like anybody, we're very grateful and thankful for
the
accomplishments. But tomorrow, you know, it's like the ball, you know, it's the rucker. Like, you know what I'm saying? I want to show and prove every day. So, you know, I try to strive to continuously to, you know, be part of the culture and be relevant and amass, you know, more success.
I mean, Lover, shout out to you. You know, Saturday mornings, that's what, if it wasn't for your MTV Raps, we wouldn't even be here.
Man, every day after school, bro.
We try to spread the gospel. I think we did a good job, man. We want a hip hop to be for everybody from every city, from every town. And I think we did a good job with that. And
Absolutely.
You know, I'm grateful to have been a part of that, man. And thank you guys for doing this Come On Son podcast.
Thanks for having
me. Especially because of you and this shit ever happened, drama. It's Ed Lover, man. It's the Come On Son podcast. As always, y'all keep God first. Everything will fall into place. Till the next time I talk to y'all. Come on, son. Fuck out of here with that bullshit.
Come on, son.
This episode of Come On, Son, the podcast, is produced and engineered by co-executive producers Kimana Paulus and Krista Hayes. Recorded at Mean Street Studios in downtown Atlanta, Georgia, this is an official Loudspeakers Network podcast.